Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We kick off our second hour today with U.S. Senator Mike Rounds calling in from Washington, D.C. Senator Rounds, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today.
We appreciate you joining us on such a big week. Happy New Year to you. Do you get to celebrate Christmas and New Year's, or do you just prepare for the upcoming session during that time?
Well, actually, we had a great opportunity to be with family during the last week, and then we left on Monday to make the commute back in. We had some events last evening that we wanted to be here for us. And then again, first thing this morning, we started with our meetings and our organizational meetings. So we've now organized in the Senate. We want to get right to work. We will have a series of items on the agenda, including the budget and with that comes the reconciliation, which is the first step in the Obama repealing process. So we're on cue, we're working it through, and we expect that we will be working a lot of overtime over the next several months.
When you say the first step in the Obama repealing process, you mean in healthcare, is that?
Correct.
Okay.
This is the Obamacare repealing process. It didn't come in with just one process. They actually started with a bill, and then they used reconciliation to modify it. We'll be using what they call the reconciliation process, but in essence, it's a privileged motion, which means you pass it with 51 votes, and you only do basically about one of those things a year. Mm-hmm. We saved one from last year, hoping that we might have a Republican president, and so we will have two reconciliation bills, one for fiscal year 17 and one for fiscal year 18, that we will probably try and get done in the first 6 months. And with that will come an extended time frame in which we lay out a transition period from a government-run system in Obamacare to one which is more focused on the patient and on the marketplace and on competition and on literally allowing physicians and their patients to be able to make more decisions with less interference from government. But it will take time to work its way through, and for a lot of folks out there that have said, look, we have concerns about stability within healthcare, that's the reason why we're going to take our time. This is a case of where we don't intend to pass the bill to find out what's in it. We intend to know what's in the bill before we pass it.
And that we are taking questions from listeners today, and the very first question that came in was asking for specifics on that, and how would you improve the Affordable Health Care Act, or do you favor elimination of a national health care option? Can you address that question specifically?
Well, there's a couple of items that I think people have specific concerns with. Mm-hmm. Number one, anything that we do, it sounds to me right now that all of the different discussions we've had include portability, so that if you want to move from one company to another as a group, you maintain that. Pre-existing conditions, once you're in the process and you move your group from one group to another, you don't have pre-existing conditions that are lost, so you have that continuation of coverage. Those were two items that a lot of people were concerned about. Another one was for people that have kids on their family plan. Can they keep them on their family plan? And so far, everything that we've heard kind of follows what we had in South Dakota to begin with before Obamacare came in, which we went to age 29, and Obamacare brought it back down to age 26. But we think it'll stay till at least age 26 in any provision that we've seen so far. And then finally, the panels. There were actually, some people called them the death panels. They weren't death panels. What they were is they were panels that were set up to basically start talking about where there could be cost cutting, and we held those off. We put provisions within laws so far that stopped those from committees from actually being established, but we will permanently eliminate that in any reform efforts that we do. The other part of this that is perhaps the most challenging is that right now different states get different amounts of money coming back from the federal government based upon those who expanded Medicaid and those who disagreed with the rules under the expansion of Medicaid. We think there will be a change in the rules for the expansion of Medicaid and then an equalization so that those states that would prefer to have their own plans in place can do so and still be eligible for the transition dollars. The other part that we have to be able to work through, and this is part of what takes time, is that we want to make it so that states can innovate, that they don't have to adhere to the rigidity that you find within Obamacare right now as far as the set policies that have to be offered. And as we do that, we want more innovation so that if you've got a doctor's group that wants to offer a different type of a product, or you have an insurance company that can put together a different kind of a product with benefits that are perhaps more liking to a particular regional area, that they can offer. Today you had to have had special waivers, and those waivers were only going to start to be granted in 2017, but they still had the rigidity of meeting all the requirements of the original Obamacare plan. So those particular forms and so forth we think will be relaxed. We are taking a lot of input from governors around the country. We're asking for more input. I personally have asked for input from the different healthcare organizations in South Dakota, and I got some really good input about the things that they were concerned about payments coming through, about the ability of doctors to continue to be able to do their own organizations or their own groups to negotiate with insurance companies and so forth. So I think there's been some very positive things that we've learned through the Obamacare process. We'll keep the pieces that people liked, and we will discard those items which people feared or did not like or that were literally out of control in terms of cost.
Do you think at this point that it's looking like it's possible to have some kind of strong consensus to move some of those things forward?
I don't think we'll find any Democrat support whatsoever. Just as Republicans refused to support unanimously the Obamacare when it was put in place, I think you'll find Democrats probably in the same boat, and they will be expected by their party leadership to be lockstep on it. So what we will do is to use the reconciliation process, which allows us to pass this with a majority vote only. And since we have 52 in the Senate, if we keep all 52 Republicans together, we'll be able to make the first series to repeal a number of the parts of the Obamacare law. But then in doing so, we begin that transition period where people don't lose coverages, but that they can see down the line when certain changes will occur, both in terms of the money going back to the states as far as the subsidies for certain plans and so forth, but they can also see the options for state assistance that we hope to be able to build in on a more equitable basis for states that did not, such as South Dakota, that did not expand Medicaid. Mm.
So at this point, how prepared do you think? There's been some time to think about this and to hammer out an alternative to the Affordable Care Act. How prepared is the Republican Party to create and implement a solution that keeps those key elements that people are the most concerned about in place?
I think we have a very strong case for being able to maintain those provisions that people care the most about. The real issue will be how do you transition in a case where some states are getting more money than other states for Medicaid expansion. How do you go back in and allow the Secretary of Health and Human Services to renegotiate so that different states who have different ideas about how to provide those services can do so? That'll be the finer point and the part that will take the most to allow the states more flexibility. And if you've got 50 different states, you may very well have 50 different plans. The nice thing in the United States is that's really the laboratory for making innovation are the states. And states are really good at copying one another as they see innovative approaches. You may find some urban states that have one approach and some rural states that have a different approach to how they want to lay out the guidelines for a Medicaid expansion program. Mm. In South Dakota, one of the concerns was that the federal government required that if we did the Medicaid expansion, that we had to include coverage even for those people who didn't want to work but still wanted health care. And we said no. You know, in South Dakota, we said time out. We think if you are capable of working and you just decide not to, why should the taxpayer pick up your health care costs? And yet that was one of the requirements in Obamacare. And, you know, that might be one of the things that that is the easiest to change around to allow states to offer an enhancement to Medicaid, but not to necessarily provide it to all of those individuals who could, if they wanted to work or are capable of working, could participate and actually provide some health care themselves. Mm. Those are some of the examples of what we're seeing, and that will take longer, and that's the reason why a transition period is very important, to transition out of this mandatory series of guidelines to ones in which there is much more flexibility for states to do what they think is best at the local level or for their constituents.
Are you finding, Senator Rounds, that your personal background in insurance and as a governor of South Dakota is helping you in the sort of the specifics of sort of repealing and reinventing healthcare in America at this point?
I think both have been very helpful. For first, while I was actually serving in the South Dakota legislature, we did major health reform in South Dakota for group and small and individual health care plans. A lot of that was in place all the way up through 2009 and 2010 when Obamacare came in. But, you know, we did the guaranteed portability already. We did the guaranteed renewability. We had actually, in my first term as governor, we created a state-sponsored health pool that was actually working for people that couldn't get insurance anyplace else and who had lost it through no fault of their own. And so a number of those items, along with a slightly better than basic understanding of how Medicaid works, has been helpful for me here. This is one of those things where there's been enough changes made over the time period that it's still a learning process for all of us. Mm. The one area that I tell people that I constantly hear folks talk about is the key to this is simply selling insurance across state lines. And we've always been able to do that. The difference is that I think some people think that, if you're from New Jersey and you want to go on the Internet and find an inexpensive rate in South Dakota, you ought to be able to join a group rate in South Dakota. And we most certainly don't want that, because that means that when you haven't done the litigation reforms and you have much more expensive costs associated with some of your urban areas, such as the East Coast, you don't want paying those prices to impact the premiums in South Dakota for South Dakota groups. And so you got to be careful that if when you sell across state lines, you take into account the regional and local costs associated with that, and that you can charge appropriate premiums based on whether or not the states have done a good job of reforming their litigation or their health care practices.
If you're just joining us, our guest is U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. He's calling in from Washington. Senator Rounds, we're receiving some text questions from folks. So I'm going to give that number one more time, 605-956-7372, 956-SDPB. You can text us a question for Senator Rounds now. And Senator Rounds, we have a caller who thinks the Republicans were silent with so many of President Obama's executive orders, and they'd like to know why.
I'm sorry, say that again. They would like to know what?
The question is if you could explain why the Republicans in the Senate were so silent with so many of President Obama's executive orders. Interesting question. Would you like to address that one?
Oh, okay. When an executive order comes through, it is an executive order issued by the executive branch of government, and it impacts the executive branch of government. And in most cases, it takes a law passed by Congress and signed by the president to actually change it. So we do not have the ability to impact executive orders that a president signs into law. The good news is that a new president stepping in can and will have the ability to change those executive orders with their new executive orders. What we've tried to do in coordinating with the new administration coming in is to lay out what the president can do on day one or on day two in terms of issuing executive orders. Second of all, those areas where there is guidance coming from department heads that can be changed when we change and add in new secretaries of the different departments. So our priority in the Senate, since we're kind of in the personnel business, because we have to approve all of these secretaries from the different departments. We will spend a huge amount of the first 100 days getting the cabinet in place. We have to vote on them, and they can take up to, I believe, up to 30 hours in some cases apiece. In some cases, there will be some privileged motions that will take up to 10 hours apiece. But we will have to vote on each one of them before they can go in and actually start changing the guidance within their departments. There is, though, also the rulemaking, and the rulemaking that has occurred at the executive branch level, which is separate from an executive order. The rulemaking, if it was done from like about May 20th forward, somewhere in that neighborhood, we can't do anything with it until the new president is sworn in. But we can do a Congressional Review Act, and the Congressional Review Act only takes 51 votes, but it takes 30 hours of discussion for each separate rule that we do. And each one of those rules has to be voted on separately. So we'll have a whole host of rules that have been put in place by the Obama administration on their way out that we will have to work our way through the process of repealing using the Congressional Review Act. The House will pass it first. It'll come to the Senate, and then we'll have to have several hours of debate on each one minimum, and that means a minimum of 5, a maximum of 10 probably. So that's a full a day basically for each one of them. But we're going to try to expedite that process and get as many of those done as we possibly can in the first 60 days of the new administration. So, and just in summary, the executive orders we can't do anything with unless we can pass a law. It's easier for the new president coming in to simply issue their own executive order and take out the old executive order. Rulemaking itself, we can undo and at the congressional level using the Congressional Review Act, but it does take more time, and we'll have a lot of those that will be on the agenda that we will accomplish. And then finally, when it comes to what they call the actual interpretation or guidance that they're giving to the rules, the sooner we get those new department heads in place, the sooner they can start to roll back on some of the guidance that was laid out there by the previous administration.
So another question coming in via text now. Senator Rounds, going back to what you were talking about, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, this caller says, rather than repealing it, it sounds like it's being changed, and if so, why wasn't it started before now?
I'm only catching part of what you're saying. Can you say that again, please?
Yes, we have a caller who says it sounds like rather than repealing the Affordable Care Act, it's just being changed. And if so, why wasn't that started before now?
Because what we did previously was to create what we call the parliamentary approved process, in which we laid out what we wanted to do in the reconciliation bill. The reconciliation bill is the repealer. But when you do the repealer through reconciliation, it's what they call a privileged motion, which means you can do it with 51 votes instead of 60. And in order to do that, you have to get the parliamentarian to agree that it meets the rules that keep it as a privileged motion. So the first year that we were in, we laid out for the president the repealer and sent it on through, which he vetoed. And then that means it would take 2/3 vote, which we do not have in the Senate because we don't have a 2/3 vote. So even though we tried to repeal it, we knew that with 2/3 vote being required, we would never get that. We don't have that many votes in favor of repealing Obamacare. Because we only had 54 members in the Senate that were Republican. And so, but what we did was we did the test case last year. Then we saved the second one, and that's the fiscal year 17 one. We've got that ready to go now, and we'll have that out, and we'll be doing it as soon as the new president is installed, as soon as they're inaugurated. But the reason why we couldn't do it earlier is because we didn't have the votes. It takes 2/3 votes because you'd have to override a presidential veto. And we proved that because we passed the first one, and he vetoed it just as we expected. So we saved the second one, the fiscal year 17 reconciliation. That's the one that we've got all set, all ready to go. We already know that it passes parliamentary approval. and it can be passed with just 51 votes, and it'll come from the House to the Senate. The Senate passes it. Any changes we then do in the reconciliation of the budget, and that's a 51 vote on that bill. It's a privileged vote. That's the reason why we're able to accomplish it without having 60 votes. And that's the reason why it hasn't been done beforehand, is we just didn't have the votes to get it done.
Senator Mike Rounds, I know that you have a busy schedule, so we need to let you go. Lots of questions we didn't get to, so I'm hoping you will come back soon, especially about cybersecurity and cyber threats. Talk to us again soon. We're hoping we can get you back. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
After the break, SDPB's Lee Strubinger talks with Secretary of State Chantel Krebs about the need for an ethics commission in South Dakota state government. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB's Lee Strubinger had a chance to speak with Secretary of State Chantel Krebs for a state legislative session preview. Lee Strubinger joins us now from our studios in Rapid City. Lee, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks for having me.
Give us an idea about what Secretary Krebs had to say about the coming session.
Sure. Well, as you may or may not know, the South Dakota Secretary of State also sits on the Board of Elections. So some of the stuff that she hopes to bring forward is election focused.
Such as?
Well, remember all the information that we had surrounding those like 10, 12, 15, 20 ballot questions that we had in November?
Yeah.
Not only did we have like an attorney general's interpretation of like each measure to vote on, but we also had a pro and con statement from supporters and opponents of each particular measure. And Secretary of State Chantel Krebs says she wants to get rid of the pro-con portion of the ballot question pamphlets.
It just became too political. And this is use of taxpayer money, printing off over 25,000 copies to be distributed to the public as they wish and want. And I felt that with the political tones that were in it, I just didn't think it was necessary to be in there, and I don't think it's a wise use of money, and so I want to eliminate that. But I do want to have contact information for those that would support or a sponsor of the question or the ballot question, and those that would oppose it have a contact so that individuals or citizens can essentially do their homework and reach out to those individuals to find out more information about the outcome or what would be the cause and effect of a ballot question if they voted for it or against it.
What else did Secretary Krebs indicate she'd like to bring forth, Lee?
Well, recall in the summer, I guess, of last year, 2016, Secretary Krebs and the Board of Elections put together a campaign finance task force. She said she wants to bring forth some campaign finance-related measures that she says has better language than the voter-approved initiated Measure 22 Anti-Corruption Act that we've been hearing so much about. Mm. She says much of that would go towards like the disclosure requirements, like people giving money to candidates and that sort of thing, and also refining the dollar amounts that can be contributed. When I talked to her, we didn't really go into too much detail about those requirements, but kind of alongside of the initiated Measure 22 line, Krebs says she is in favor of creating an ethics commission, which was a part of initiated Measure 22, and lawmakers are currently challenging the constitutionality of that ethics commission in the IM-22 case.
You know, I've said for a long time that I think South Dakota does need an ethics commission, and specifically when it comes to campaign finance laws or lobbying laws, so that there is somewhat of an oversight and checks and balances. And, you know, when you look at state government as a whole, there would be room for that in the campaign finance area, and I would be in favor and support and be willing to work with language that the legislators are going to be proposing to help draft anything that they have for an ethics commission. And I actually have some language penciled out already as a starting point for them.
Wasn't one of the reasons that IM-22 was challenged in court had to do with the ethics commission being beholden to a particular branch of government?
Right, right. It wasn't outlined in that measure, or so they say. And so I asked her about that, and she does agree that the Ethics Commission does have to fall under the guise of possibly a constitutional officer or a branch of government, much like the Board of Elections does with the Secretary of State's office. She says that someone has to be an administrator to the Ethics Commission process.
You've done some reporting in the past about Krebs hiring additional staff just to manage enforcing IM-22 with that injunction in place. Is she still planning on those staff members?
She says, Krebs says she's in a wait and see mode right now. And obviously with the injunction on the entire law, she doesn't really have to hire that additional staff, but she says she's always ready to.
Our office is still prepared to say if it proceeds or any of the language proceeds where the requirement of the oversight is passed with the language that's currently in it, then we need to say we have to probably add some staff. It just is, it's so unreasonable to be able to do it with our current staff of only 14, which oversees not only elections, but all the business services division and the concealed carry weapon permits division, the notaries, and everything else that we have in our office.
And Secretary of State Krebs also says that no matter the outcome of the initiated Measure 22 lawsuit or whether or not lawmakers tool around with the measure a little bit, it will have some effect on her office no matter what.
Lee Strubinger reaching us from our studios in Rapid City. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Melissa Hyatt is a South Dakota chaplain. If you've heard of author and shame researcher Brené Brown, well, she's one of Melissa's favorites. She teaches workshops following the principles of Brené Brown's work based on the books Daring Greatly and Rising Strong. Melissa Hyatt wrote a newspaper column recently about one of the most valuable lessons she's learned as an adult. We asked her to share it with us.
The best gift I've ever been given was not being liked. I was doing a chaplain residency when I sensed that Karen, one of my supervisors, really didn't like me, or at least wasn't overly impressed. I was one of 8 residents, and there was one other supervisor. Every quarter, each resident was required to write a 10 to 12 page paper, including verbatims, and reflect upon our developing theories and work as chaplains. I learned to receive and give feedback as we shared our work among that group. It was a rich learning environment. However, it was Karen's approval that I sought. Karen was good, and there was a part of me that knew she could see through my perfection, and I wondered what she saw. It was the last time we would all be together, and I wanted to get a good job from Karen. I presented my year's worth of learning and received constructive feedback from everyone except Karen. Karen sat silent. We were about to move on when Karen finally spoke. She asked, "Melissa, are you a good chaplain?" I paused and said, "I hope so." She asked again, "Melissa, are you a good chaplain?" I thought for a minute and said, "I'm trying to be." A third time she asked, "Melissa, are you a good chaplain?" This time I looked down at what represented a year's worth of hard work. It wasn't perfect, but I had done a lot of good, even great work. I looked up and said, "Yes, I'm a good chaplain." Karen said, "Then why are you waiting for people to tell you?" In that moment, a shift occurred in my thinking and understanding about me and my worth. My whole life, in subtle ways, I had let people tell me if I was good or not. I had let other people determine my worth. I was dependent upon recognition and praise to feel good about myself. Karen gave me a life-changing gift that day. And as a result, I began to trust myself. I am not perfect, but I am really good at what I do. Praise does not inflate me like it used to, and criticism refines me rather than defeats me. When we need others to validate our worth, we use people, we manipulate people, and most often we deceive ourselves. I'm not perfect, but that's not the point. I believe in who God has created me to be, and I try to lean into the moments God entrusts to me. Now I know that I'm good at what I do. I'm a good mom, I'm a good wife, and I'm a good chaplain. I'm good at being me.
That's Chaplain Melissa Hyatt from Sioux Falls reading a column she wrote for the Argus Leader newspaper. We'd like to know what you're writing. Send us an email in the moment at sdpb.org. And when we come back, John Pelletier is back with financial tips for the new year. You're listening to In the Moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. How much do you understand about your own money? John Pelletier is director of the Champlin College Center for Financial Literacy. On Monday, we talked with him about South Dakota's score on the National Adult Financial Literacy Report Card. We earned a B+, graded on a curve. Today, we continue that conversation with John by talking about where to begin tackling the big money issues in your life. Give me an idea of some of those places to start then with financial literacy. And is it something that we all take individual responsibility for? We need to educate ourselves, seek out the information where we're at to take the next step? Or is it more of a public policy concern or a concern for education? How do you see it?
It's both. I mean, it is really both. So, you know, in the K through 12 space, I mean, here's what we know, right? We know that there are a lot of parents who don't understand this, mm-hmm. and yet the number one place a child's going to look for financial advice is their parents. So we know that. And the question then becomes, is it happening in your schools? And, you know, I have another report I do just on the public policy or the policy aspects that's required in the high school. So when we did our report and graded the states in 2015, October 2015, South Dakota got an F because you really don't require something occur in high school where students either take a standalone course in personal finance or maybe a portion of a required course for graduation like economics is dedicated to personal finance topics. Mm-hmm. So you can graduate, and I'm sure many people do in South Dakota, without ever having taken a personal finance course. That doesn't mean people aren't taking them. I'm sure they're offered in electives in many high schools in the states, and I'm sure there's given the local control that exists in your state, I'm sure there are some great school districts that require it as a high school graduation requirement. The point is it's not required across all schools in all the states. So
sure.
You're not getting it there. You're probably not really getting anything of this nature in college either. And not everyone goes to college.
You might need it before you go to college and take out your loans.
you do in South Dakota. I would say that the one area where South Dakota got an F is in student loans.
Really?
The 69% of South Dakotans, students who go to school in South Dakota, they're taking out student loans. They're graduating with an average debt of $26,000. And shockingly, this is a pretty low figure, and low relative to national survey data. Only 26% of students from South Dakota, adult students who took out a student loan, tried to figure out their monthly payments before getting their student loans. And only 35% of adult South Dakotans with student loans have never made a late payment. So that means about 65% of them have made late payments. When you make a late payment, that's going to negatively impact your credit score. So it clearly belongs in the schools,
right.
I believe, and I think that's a public policy issue.
Yeah.
There are other public policies that can be promoted. One area where you don't do well is when you ask adults, did you use one or more non-bank borrowing methods in the past 5 years? More than a quarter of South Dakotans have. And those are things like payday loans, auto title loans, rent to own, very, very expensive things with incredibly high embedded annual percentage rates on the financing that are embedded in these types of products or going to pawn shops. There are a variety of states. I live in one where payday loans are outlawed. They're just not even allowed.
So this year we passed a ballot initiative, a voter-approved ballot initiative that put a cap on the interest rates for payday lending, and now the number is slipping me. I think it's 34%. Is that?
Oh, that's great.
That's great. You like that new change?
I like that very much. I mean, and those are, so there is public policy that can help. So those are examples of public policy, but so much of personal finance, is individual driven. You also, what's important, I think, is that people be given the opportunity to understand some of these topics. And again, I think school's the right place. And there was one survey done. It's a bit old, but I love it because it was done a couple of years by Charles Schwab. And they surveyed parents about topics they were comfortable or uncomfortable talking to their children about. And what was scary is the percent of parents saying they were comfortable talking to their children about money was 1% higher. So 1% slightly greater comfort level than the percent of parents saying they were comfortable talking to their children about sex. And the year before that, it was the opposite. Where money was actually more uncomfortable than sex.
I'm a parent, and I can tell you, I don't even know whether to teach my kid how to balance a checkbook. Is the information I have relevant to my kid, and where do I begin having those conversations? Especially when I look at if I open my book, she's going to see the things that I didn't do very well, too.
That's a great point. I mean, you've got for kids today, that debit card.
Right.
Is different, and many of these kids who have debit cards, do they have their banking app on their phone? And if they are they making sure they're securing their phone in an appropriate way so that someone who steals the phone can't get access to other personal information? But understanding, kids today are probably able to, if they want, through online banking, to get fairly instantaneous information about their savings. What they need to understand are things like compound interest, and the fact that if you want to be a millionaire, the amount of money you have to save to be a millionaire each and every day in your 20s is totally different than if you suddenly want to save $1 million in your 50.
Sure.
And the reason for that is if you can get slightly more than 77% a year, you can double your money every decade. So when I talk to young people, I always tell them what they have is something I don't, decades. They have decades and decades in front of them.
Yeah.
And that small amounts can grow fairly quickly. So an example would be if, grandpa leaves you $10,000 when you're 18, and you don't touch that until you're 68. That $10,000, if you can put it in a long-term investment, like say the S&P 500, which over a very long period of time, and again I'm talking 50 years, should get on average based on history a little bit more than 7%. If you put it there and left it alone, that $10,000 becomes $320,000. And that's what's lost on people. And what's really sad is, if you have access to a 401k plan, what a lot of young people do when they leave their first job after 2 or 3 years, their employer says, I don't want your small little 401k account. So what do you want to do? Do you want a check, or are you going to roll it over to an IRA or to your next employer's 401k? A frightening amount of young people just take the cash because they go, hey, it's $5,000 or $7,000. There's no way I'm going to live off that when I retire. And maybe they take that trip to Aruba or Cozumel or wherever they go. There are lots of little mistakes that kind of add up over time. But, understanding compound interest, understanding that saving early is important, understanding the need for a rainy day fund, understanding the need to save for your own retirement, understanding how credit scores work, and trying to find out what yours is so you can minimize your cost of credit for your entire life. The things that you need to know are not crazily complex, but they require some level of education or self-discovery.
Where do you start getting some of that information? Do you have favorite sources or some basics? We're starting a new year. Finances has to be on a lot of people's minds right now of goals they have for the new year? Where do we begin getting smarter?
I think one of the best places out there, because they're totally unbiased. I mean, that's really, you always go, boy, I want to go somewhere where they're totally unbiased. The National Endowment for Financial Education is funded by a large endowment. They do not take money from any financial institutions. Mm. They provide a great deal of free education. They have one of the most highly used free, 100% free educational programs in high schools. So if there's a standalone personal finance course and an educator's looking for a soup to nuts program to start with, they'll send you booklets for every kid in your classroom for free. You go online, you fill it out, and you can give these students that information. They have great information online. It's free. You can see everything. So you, when you go to their website, you can click on it if your focus is on your child as a student, and get that information. They also have a site with some really good information and advice for adults. They also have a program that you can get access to through many colleges. It's called the Cash Course that they make available. It's on a lot of colleges' websites. Again, they make it available for free. So there's so many different places you can go to for advice. Another place you can look for some information is mymoney.gov, which is the federal site.
Okay.
That gives all the information they have available from about 18 different government agencies. But if you're looking for unbiased information, and frankly, there are some pretty good books out there that you can look at. One's a little bit outdated. You can still get it in paperback. I think it's fairly inexpensive. I think it's one that I know a lot of young people I've worked with have enjoyed reading. It's a readable book by David Bach, B-A-C-H. It's called The Automatic Millionaire.
Okay.
And it really shows how if you take a couple simple concepts, like always putting money aside, paying yourself first, that's one way to move ahead.
Mm.
The hard part, I think, about saving, the hardest thing about saving is kind of like muscle memory, right? If you don't do it, how are you going to, you got to get that muscle memory going. The thing that's interesting to me about saving is, people forget that every time that we make a decision to spend money on something that isn't a life necessity, so it's not food we need, clothing, housing, transportation. Anytime we spend money on these little luxuries, we're making a decision not to save. And little amounts can add up over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can get into the savings habit, a great example would be the best advice I was ever given at a young age was by an older gentleman just before he retired, who took me out to lunch when I was starting work for the first time. with regard to the 401k plan we had, and he asked me, "Are you maxing out on that?" And I said, "No, of course not. That's a huge amount, and I don't have that much money. I'm starting out. I have student loans." But what he told me is, okay, do yourself a favor. Every time you get a raise, before you get used to that raise, that 3 or 4% more money you're going to get, take half of it and allocate it to your 401k plan. So still keep half of it, but allocate the other half to yourself. Pay yourself first. Put it away for the future before you even get used to that increased paycheck. Because you're used to the old paycheck. You're still going to have, 2% or 1.5% more. And you'll be surprised how quickly you can get to maxing out on your retirement account over time. But it's really that conscious effort of making it a bit kind of almost habit-forming.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hard thing.
If you're starting out 2017 in debt, what is the best thing that you can do to turn that around?
Well, it depends. You know, it depends how much debt you're in, right? If you're in really life paralyzing debt, I would strongly suggest you go online and look for nonprofit credit counselors. Mm-hmm. Not these people who say, "Pay me $500 and I'll help you." For folks who are in debt, you know, it's like when you're in a ditch, stop digging. Don't add more debt to it, right? Yeah. Try not to.
You
do
sounded
that.
Like now, my dad right then.
Oh, I mean, it's, right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of common sense. Is you know, don't go out and buy more stuff.
You're the kind of guy that fills your gas tank up when it's half empty, too, aren't you? I can just tell, right? That was my dad, too.
When it's close to a quarter, I go, okay. It's going to be above quarter, not quite half, but it's between a half and a quarter. But yeah, you definitely want to do that. And you know, the other thing is, you know, look at your debt and understand the payment obligations. And you probably, if you can, want to pay down the most expensive debt first. There's other theories on this, by the way, that are more behavioral in nature. So the more behavioral ones say, you know, if you've got three credit cards, even though it may be your lowest debt, your lowest interest rate, the one that's the smallest, pay that one off first so you get the feeling of getting out of debt on one credit card. So there are two schools of thought on this. One is, you know, purely accounting mathematical, and you, of course, always pay off the most expensive debt first. There's another school of thought that says, no, what you really want is the psychological positive benefit of getting debt-free on one of those items you're trying to knock off, so it gives you the confidence to keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I think both of those are very workable solutions depending on the way you respond to stimuli, right?
Yeah. Well, we don't want to be beat by Minnesota and North Dakota ever again. So we're on it, John, and I can tell you next time.
Oh, that's great.
We're gonna make some progress. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today. It's really been informative and a great way to start the year as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for your time. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.